Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mattis, and on this episode 115 of The Prerogative, we take a look at the 1977 Walt Disney classic, The Rescuers, as we continue Disney Month! Yes, that is right, it is Disney Month continuing here on Tom's Prerogative, and I'm glad you're joining me for it. You know, as I said before, this is one of my favorite months of the year, or at least whichever month I decide to do Disney Month, because in the 3 years of doing Tom's Prerogative so far, you know, this being my third year, Disney Month has kind of jumped around. First year was in February, last year was February, March, and kind of April, and now I'm really doing it, like, trying to squeeze it all in the tail end of March, it seems. Of course, for that story, I harken back to the last episode of the explanation there. So, but The Rescuers is a fairly important film in Walt Disney history. You know, it came out during what I've always said, it's that sort of gloomy period where there wasn't a lot of success for the animation studio at Walt Disney. With Rescuers being one of the few, it was had $48 million, making it Disney's most successful film at that point. The film broke records for the largest financial amount made by an animated film on its opening weekend. A film that was kept until 1986, when American Tail broke it, another feature featuring mice, also featuring another animator, as we'll talk about in a second. And Rescuers was its first significant success since 1967's Jungle Book, and would be its last until 1989 in The Little Mermaid. You know, also important is some of the process and some of the people involved in it. You know, during this time, one of the things I think that made, or at least that hurt Disney's animation product, as, you know, me and my good friend Gerard talked about when we reviewed Sleeping Beauty last year, was that after Sleeping Beauty, part of the blame was placed on hand-drawn animation, so they switched to a Xerox process, which at the time wasn't good because it had a lot of black outlines, which made a lot of hard line work and everything. But, you know, at this point it had been approved to use a medium-grade toner, and so this film had a little bit more softer look in that standpoint. Something that would become more classic Disney. Also, this would mark the last joint effort between Milton Caul, Ollie Johnson, and Frank Thomas, part of the original Eight Old Men. This would also be actually be the first Disney film in which Don Bluth worked on as an animator, not as an assistant animator. Of course, Don Bluth would at some point later then leave Disney and start his own company again and create things like The Secret of Nim and American Tales, as we just mentioned. And also some animators who stepped up during the production. And this was some of their first big work for Disney. Were animators Glenn Keane, story artist Ron Clements, and Andy Gaskill, who all would play important parts in Disney's renaissance. In particular, again, Glenn Keane and Ron Clements are particularly remembered for their work in the Disney, at least by me. Of course, Glenn Keane would, he'd be the premier sort of prince artist, you know, working on Aladdin, Prince Eric, The Beast. And, you know, Ron Clements, Gordon, and John Musker would be well-renowned directors directing and producing Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Hercules, which we'll be reviewing later this month, The Princess and the Frog. So just a lot of important historical, I think, importance as far as Walt Disney Animation in connection with this movie. And certainly, you know, the fact that it was one of the few successes among this period, and I've talked about this period before, again, going back to that Xerox process. That was, you know, well, we'll do this in replacement of the hand-drawn, because the blame was placed on the hand-drawn because it cost so much. Not the fact that it took, like, 6 years to make, but that's besides the point. But I think the point I'm making here is, again, this was definitely a period where the art wasn't as good, and the product wasn't as good. The product was enjoyable, but not good. Not to the standard in which, you know, the early Disney films set. And we've talked a bit about it in reviewing things like Robin Hood, and I think The Sword in the Stone, which we reviewed before. So this was definitely a period where it had few successes, and like I said, this is one of them, so it's going to be very interesting to review it today. Now, before I get into the review proper, I do actually want to talk about another Disney film. Now, even though I recorded it after I went and saw it, I decided to wait till this recording to talk about it. Last weekend, opening weekend for that matter, I did go see Cinderella. And I want to give my sort of short review on it. And my short review is, I absolutely love everything about this film. I mean, my God. This is such an improvement over Maleficent. I mean, I have very few criticisms. Really, the one major one is the awful animated short by... what was that franchise or that film that's now being made? Oh, yeah, that's right, Frozen. Now, you may say that, oh, that's just you hating on Frozen because you don't like Frozen. No. By context, the short should have been funny and hilarious. The problem is the same problem with the Frozen movie in which they have to sing everything. To which I say, look, I understand it. Mendes has become a huge popular star, and she was a popular star now even more because she does Elsa, and Let It Go is a big popular song, well, Do You Want to Build a Snowman, and all that stuff, and blah, 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 of the overrated music of Frozen. You know, you don't have to sing everything. Again, singing plot ruins the story. You don't get what makes a musical a musical. You don't... Oh. This piece was supposed to be about comedy, and it should have focused on the comedy. Instead, the whole focus of the short focuses on Anne singing, and the comedy is second nature. And I don't even have to go to Beauty and the Beast or anything of the Disney Renaissance to prove why this was the wrong thing to do. I only need to go back to... what was it? I think Maleficent, in fact, was what showed the short. Though it may have been something else, and I can't remember. It was some Disney film that had the short. But I'm going back to the Tangled short, in which, you know, where the chameleon and the horse, Maximus, are the ring bearers, and they lose the ring, and they have to chase the ring. There's no song there. Nothing. It's just all about the comedy. And that's where it works, and it's wonderful and hilarious. Why? Because it was, actually, you know, oddly enough, you know what it was? I think it was Frozen that the short was before. Which would be really funny right about now. So is it that short didn't work? And, I mean, but the fact that that's my big criticism shows you how much I love this film. I mean, there's some minor criticisms in that I feel they could have used some of the music for. In fact, during the credits, they play, you know, "A Dream Is Your Heart, Your Wish Makes," which was actually sung, and "Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo," that was sung by the actors who played them in the movie. I actually don't have the cast list up here, so I'm blanking on names, and I apologize. And again, this is a short review. Maybe at some point I'll do a much more in-depth review. But, yeah, at same point in time, those scenes, they were done in a way to where I could see why they didn't use the music. But I almost wonder if they did the scenes with the songs in them, and I would love to see those scenes with them. But outside of that, I loved everything about it. I mean, all the actors nailed the characters. Cate Blanchett nailed Lady Tremaine. Just oozed evil. Again, we're allowing evil to just be evil. Thank you, Disney. You know, again, I made mention that I thought this was such an improvement over Maleficent. And, you know, I've had some friends who say, you know, I don't understand, you know, different boats float different ways. And I'll agree with that. But my reasoning for that is, you know, Maleficent. Yeah, and yes, I understand the whole movie was centered around her. But they did nothing to make me connect with her character to why I should feel bad to her. And I just sit there most of the time wondering, like, you know, the best part of this film is when they allow Maleficent to be evil. So why can't we allow her to be evil? You know, and of course all the other things, the ruining of the three good fairies and just the absolute blasphemy that they did with that those characters. And some of the deeper, you know, feminist agenda, and I hate to use that term, and I'm sure that turns a lot of people off me saying that, because it probably feels like I'm being disingenuous to those views. I'm not, but again, I didn't go to the film expecting to have a sort of feminist character pushed upon me. And I really didn't enjoy that. I went the film hoping to see Maleficent be evil. But for what reason we couldn't get that? Because we can't relish in a character being evil. Whereas this film, evil characters, and again, you connect with each of them. They did a great, you know, Cate Blanchett, they did a great job without really telling why, but showcasing, you know, she's evil because she has been locked in that race for money and power. And that's all she cares about. She cares about her status. Everything she's doing is about her status. Everything she's, the fact that she's trying to marry off her daughters, who she hates. And particularly at that point of, she hates Cinderella because Cinderella is the daughter she wants to have that she could marry to the wealthiest person and grow her status. Instead, she has these two daughters who are ugly and have nothing about them that she knows she can't marry off to somebody good. And everything is about her status. So it's just, oh god, it was just perfectly played. And again, I'm blanking on the beautiful young woman who played Cinderella. Oh my god, she was wonderful as that kid. She was strong, independent, beautiful. Played that character wonderfully. Just everything about her that she did, I just instantly connected with the character. The same with the prince. I love the prince. Again, I think this is a perfect example of that. If this film had been made during the Disney, this is what the film would have been if it had been made in the Disney Renaissance. I mean, at least this is what the prince would have been, because it would have definitely had more story to it. And oh my god, my favorite moment, because again, I don't think, by the way, spoiler alert for this film if you haven't seen it, but pretty much, spoiler, the film follows the exact same storyline as the animated film. Though it has some more stuff at the beginning, basically. But the end part, as far as going to the ball and the, you know, the shoe fitting, that all fits. But the big reveal is the whole point of that the prince isn't stupid. And, you know, gets one up on the Duke, who's trying to get one up on him. But him and his partner, and just, they're able to foil the Duke's plan and find Cinderella. It's, oh my god, it was wonderful. I know I said spoiler. I really actually didn't spoil it. I mean, really, you should go for yourself. Because I don't want to spoil it. Because it was such, it's a beautiful scene. I mean, when it happened, everybody started clapping. There was a girl behind me. She was one of those teenagers where everything sucked. She even thought Frozen sucked. And she's the main fan base for Frozen, and she hated it. She hated everything. She was clapping and cheering for what the prince did, which shows you how much power it had. And I think the other thing about this film is the multiculturalness of it. It's just, oh my god. This is how we should introduce multiculturalness into, you know, pop culture. You know, instead of focusing on changing the color and the gender of these main characters, we should be changing the world around them, because I think that has a much more important impact on the world than it does on just changing the main characters. I mean, you had people of Asian and black and Spanish, Latino, all different types of descent in this kingdom, and it was wonderful. And they all felt like they had all this respect and importance to it. It was wonderful. So, I cannot highly suggest going to see Cinderella. If you're looking for something different, that's like, oh, it's going to turn the fairy tale on its head. If you're one of those people, you're probably not going to like it. But if you're like me, if you just want to see the fairy tale that you remember and love told again for a new age, you will love this film. And I think that's really the dividing point. There are some people that want the sort of wicked approach of, we're going to turn the villain on his head. And then there are those like me that, you know, we know the story. We don't need the villain turned on the head. We know why the villain is doing what they're doing. We just want the fairy tale told good. We want to see good acting and the story told to its perfection, which, goddammit, they did. And if Beauty and the Beast could be this instead of Maleficent, I will be extremely happy next year. Okay? So, Disney, I'm saying this now. Make this your template for Beauty and the Beast. Do not fuck this up. Because if you fuck Beauty and the Beast up, I am hunting people down. I'm just saying this now. I'm going to hunt somebody down. Some motherfucker gonna die if they fuck up Beauty and the Beast. I'm just saying, okay? I'm not gonna say it could be a fault, but just that some motherfucker gonna have to die. Whoo! And I think I have reached my limit, because I said short review, and here I am ranting on for 10 minutes. So, with that being said, you know, let's get into our review proper, our main topic, which is The Rescuers. So, Our Rescuers, which debuted in 1977 in June 22nd, directed by Wolfgang Riederman, John Lisberry, and Art Stevens, produced by Riederman and Ron Miller. Our tale starts in the Devil's Bayou, where a young orphan by the name of Penny drops a message into the bottle. It's eventually discovered by mice in New York. How it got into New York, I don't know. They never really exactly say where the Devil's Bayou is, but they kind of give an indication like it's in somewhere in Florida or around the Bermuda Triangle. But anyways, these mice bring it to the Rescue Aid Society, an international mice organization inside the UN. There, the Hungarian representative, Miss Bianca, volunteers to accept the case and chooses Bernard, the stammering janitor, to be her co-agent. The two visit her orphanage, Morningside, where Penny lives, and they meet old cat Rufus, who tells them about Penny And through investigating, they find out that a woman by the name of Madame Medusa, who owns a thrift shop, ended up kidnapping her, and they trace it all the way back to the Devil's Bayou. They get there with the help of an albatross by the name of Ordville, and end up working with a dragonfly named Ivanrood. After a lot of wrangling, the mice outsmart Madame Medusa, her partner Mr. Snoops, and their pet alligators, who are trying to, who are basically using Penny because she's small enough to fit into a hole, to find a huge diamond called the Devil's Eye in a pirate's cave. They manage to escape and get Penny back to New York, where she gives the diamond up to the Symphonian, ends up getting adopted, and everybody lives happily ever after as Miss Bianca and Bernard go off on another adventure. Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Rescuers. Come along. Will there be sunshine shining? Will we find a silver lining? Come along. Sing a song. When today becomes tomorrow, will we find joy or sorrow? Sing a song. Is it wrong? Started off as we usually do with music. Now, first we're going to talk about the songs, as we usually do, and you know, this is a very different animal than we're used to with Disney. For the most point, a lot of Disney were used to sort of the musical aspect of it, and songs being like that. In this case, it's different in the fact that this is Disney when they use songs as part of a narrative of the film. You know, not being sung by anybody, but taking place, you know, you'd have them sung during montages. You know, for instance, when they're traveling from New York to Devil's Bayou by Albatross, and they're showing different scenes of different locations, everything, and there's montage there. So it's sung during that point, and during opening credits and things like that. All the songs are sung by Shelby Flint, who has, you know, she has a lovely voice. I think my one criticism is a lot of these songs feel like sort of the, and obviously this makes sense to sit there and say they feel like the children's songs, the nice, simple, safe children's songs that you play during reading time. It's like, you know, like I could hear these songs, in fact, be on Reading Rainbow, like, you know, being played as, you know, I should know his name by now, especially considering I donated to the whole Bring Reed Rainbow Back thing. But, like, I can picture him, like, showing the pictures of a picture book and the song playing in the background of that. That's certainly something I thought of all of the songs. And mind you, here's the thing. They're lovely, and they all worked for what they were doing in the film to tell the narrative. But it's like, it's hard, because in one instance I want to sit there and take myself back to 1977, and I want to try to forget about Disney Renaissance, because comparing them to the music of the Disney Renaissance is, like, no. And it's not fair in any ways. But at the same point in time, I have to sit there and, like, what can I compare it to? Well, I can compare it to what was set by Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty. Even something like 101 Dalmatians. or The Jungle Book. And when compared to that, it's really not as good as what Disney has done in the past. And I don't think, at least the songs, are by any means the strength of this movie. So they're nice, and they certainly accomplished their job in the movie. But, yeah, I mean, certainly you're not going to forget them as far as forgetting that the songs were in the movie. But, yeah, they're nothing you're going to be singing. They're nothing you're going to remember the lyrics to. They're just nice music that helps the narrative move along to it. You know, it gets the narrative to certain places. The score, however, is much more lovely and much more, I think, successful in the fact that, like the songs, it does its job of moving the narrative along, but certainly helps does add verbiage and adjectives to the scenes that are going on, and certainly there's a lot of fun music within the score of this movie that's very enjoyable. Certainly, I found myself enjoying a lot of scenes, but and going back and rewatching them, as I like, wow, I really like what the music did in this scene. One scene, such scene is the chase scene on the riverboat where, you know, Bernard and Bianca are found by the alligators and they're trying to chase them and trying to get them, in particular when they're stuck in the organ. And it's just, it's very Looney Tunes-esque, and it's like, I'm really digging this. Another scene that really had really great, tremendous music that added to it was when they're in the pirate's cave. So, I thought the score itself, though, was much better than the songs, and, you know, did a great job of adding that, as I like to call it, the verbiage and the adjective to the animation and story. So, wonderful job, I thought, by the score. Moving on to the animation. You know, overall, the art style, again, you know, we have to bring up that Xerox. So, definitely, it's 60s and 70s Disney animation. But there's definitely a sense of it being a bit more softer. With the line work and the colors and everything. You know, the colors aren't as bright as I would like them, but I thought the line work itself was much better than what I've seen in previous films of this era. I'm definitely looking at, like, Robin Hood, and I'm looking at Jungle Book, Sword in the Stone, just a couple of them. So, I definitely like the line work a lot more. It's just, I mean, those films, it's a bit more sketchy and everything. A lot of that dealing with the Xerox process. But there doesn't seem to be as many slip-ups in this. The line work is very clean and much more crisp than it is in other films during this era for Disney. And so, definitely, so, just the very earthy tones and the dark tones could be a bit brighter, but they don't really hurt the film. But it's like, I'm in between. I don't hate them, but I don't love them. Character designs, I really enjoyed. I thought, one thing I did like was the, really how Bernard and Bianca's character designs played off each other. The red and the white, for that matter, I thought worked really well. There's almost an Americana feel to that. And then, of course, the way they're dressed, you know, Bianca, you know, in sort of almost, I would call it imitation mink, and, you know, Bernard in the cotton. There's definitely a European feel, to Bianca that, and then Bernard, there's something about his design, about the chubbiness that I think it makes him just a great sort of Americana. You know, there's something Americana about, or excuse me, Americana everyman about Bernard's design. And again, mind you, we're talking about mice here. Mice in clothing. But Bernard has this sort of very round, American everyman feel to him. And then Bianca has it more sort of slim, sort of, I don't want to use the word sensual, but slim, smooth European feel to it, to her design. Madame Medusa is just wild. I mean, looking to the background of this film, this film was largely made by people who had worked on 101 Dalmatians, and due to certain things, she was largely based off. I mean, in fact, in one phase of this script, it was supposed to take place in Antarctica and supposed to feature Cruella De Vil, and that ended up falling. And some scripts, and it was part of a couple scripts that got combined, and they'd work on some preliminary effects. That's why Madame Medusa really has a really strong resemblance, is what I'm getting to, of Cruella De Vil. But there's, I think, enough different. Definitely her color scheme, but definitely has that very sort of just sleazy look to her that really helps with the evil aspect of what her character is doing, which we'll get to a little later. Mr. Snoop's just, I'd say classic Disney henchman look to him. It works. Some of my favorite character designs are the Devil Bayou's animal population, where you have the turtle and the rabbit and the mice and dragon, all of them. You have the owl. It's either an owl or a turtle who's displayed as like an old Civil War veteran. Because, of course, 1970s, we actually did still have Civil War veterans. It's just, I really enjoyed, because it was, I think, the designs reminded me of their, like, classic Southern people designs. And again, I do have a fondness for the South and sort of the mysticism and the mistake of the South. Not that I agree with everything that has come of the South, obviously. but there is a certain mystique to the South that has always been attracted to a lot of people. And definitely you feel that in their character designs. I mean, just go on Splash Mountain. That Southern mystique is in that ride. And there's some of that here as well. Some of my favorite scenes in this entire movie are the action sequences. And the action animation is done wonderfully. I really, really enjoyed it. I go back to the chase scene on the riverboat where the alligators are chasing the mice. That sequence was just a whole lot of fun, and I really, really enjoyed it. And it's just very fluid and well planned out, and there's a Looney Tune-esque madness to it that works really, really well. I have a sneaking suspicion that since he's part of this film, that Ron Clements may have had something to do with that sequence, and maybe that's why I really, really like it. I would be interested in interviewing him and maybe bringing that up and which sequences he was involved in, because I have a sneaking suspicion that some of those Looney Tune-esque moments, in particular of the action scenes, you know, and also like the final chase when they're trying to escape and they trap the alligators in the cage and they hijack the jet-propelled, the jet-engine swamp vehicle, which, by God, we're putting a kid on a literal jet engine. How that thing didn't the thing did explode, but again, this is fantasy, and we have to be open to imagination. But my God, and the skiing scene is like, there's a lot of fun in the action animation too. That just, I very much enjoy. To whether it be the scenes of Orville flying, there's a particular point to where Orville's trying to get away from the jet engine and gets sucked in. It's like, this is getting kind of morbid. I mean, mind you, it still is very much a cartoon to where he gets sucked out and It's like nothing's happened to him. So that idea of advent realism isn't there. One of the things that really showcases as a cartoon, mind you. Maybe that's something also to talk about here is that, you know, the locations, and this is not a criticism, but another reason I showcase this as a cartoon is, again, the locations are very sort of set-based. I can almost feel like I'm watching a play rather than a movie in the way, you know, like they'll showcase a picture of where they are. And certainly there are scenes that don't fit the cartoon style, you know, when they're in the water trying to get to the riverboat. That has a much more movie approach feel to it. But certainly those type of scenes are far and few between. There's a lot more sort of, well, here's a scene set up, feels like a set type of feel to it. But that's not a criticism either way. That's just, those are just signs of like whether this is more towards it being a cartoon or an anime. And the way the music is played and, you know, everything, it's certainly definitely more towards a cartoon. You know, and I guess last but not least is the background and the special effects. I find the background to be, you know, very interesting. And again, I think it goes back to that Southern mystique that makes the devil bayou, with all its darkness and everything, a little bit more interesting than it probably should be. Because again, in one instance, it's very, feels like it's a bayou. It tells you exactly what it is. But again, it's that Southern mystique, and I definitely think the half-sunken riverboat adds to that mystique and gives it its unique feel in regards to being probably directly identifiable with this film. For the most part, the backgrounds are being filled. You know, I think one instance where you see a beautiful use of the backgrounds is the musical montage when they are flying from New York to the Devil's Bayou. And, of course, they needed to pad out time so they could play the song. But definitely the different locations that they showed them going to added to this idea of them traveling and made that montage work that much better. And then, like I said, the special effects. Special effects, I don't think, were a big thing here. And certainly not. And there's certainly a lot of things that could have added to the special effects, but for the most part, the little use of special effect, I mean, like shadowing and everything, worked really well. So overall, I thought the animation for this film was a much improvement. I mean, you can see that everything about the animation is an improvement over pretty much anything Disney was doing at this time. You can see why it was definitely more of a success than anything else, just based off the animation. There's definitely a lot of people that I feel like stepped up. Again, I would be very interested to know in what animation Glenn Keane worked on. Because, because I'd love to see like the scenes, I think, because I definitely want to say that maybe he worked on a lot of scenes with Bernard, because there's some elements of him that feel very Glenn Keane. Definitely, I wonder if he worked on the action sequences, because if you've seen the recent duet that he and his group did, there's some elements there that I'm very reminded of in watching Rescuers as well. So overall, I very much enjoyed the animation, and I definitely think it's a strength of this film, or at least one of the strengths. With that, I think it's time for a break, and a time for me to play some promos so I can help my friends out and let them, or let you people know about some great podcasts you should be listening to. So I'm going to play a couple promos, and when we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Superman.
Captain Marvel.
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds will live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds will die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Ariane.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear
Man. The Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents...
And many, many more.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
Coming January only at twotruefreaks.com.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be. It's still going up!
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension.
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
Imagine the world you have known all your life suddenly begins to change.
The changes are almost imperceptible at first, but soon everything comes crashing around you.
Past and present contradict each other. History is no longer immutable.
Inconsistencies begin to pop up. New origins rendered stories only a few years old null and void.
Those long gone are no longer dead.
Worst of all, your friends and loved ones are vanishing. Or changing.
The very fabric of reality surrounding the DC Universe is unraveling.
In Smallville, Jor-El and Lara have returned to take Superman back to an unexploded Krypton.
In Metropolis, Superman is faced with a multitude of Batmen.
The time stream, made fragile by countless twists and myriad travels, is now spinning out of control. Time is running out. Quickly.
Only the greatest heroes of every era and reality can stop this crisis in time.
And stop it they must, or the DC Universe will cease to exist, perhaps never to have existed at all.
The heroes and villains of the DC Universe are facing their...
Zero Hour.
In 1994, DC published Zero Hour, Crisis in Time, a five-issue miniseries designed to fix some of the continuity issues that had cropped up since the conclusion of the Crisis on Infinite Earths.
This was a huge deal, and because of that, and because Superman played such a large part in that story, From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast hosted by Jeffrey Taylor
and Michael Bailey
will be covering the Superman issues, as well as Zero Hour itself.
We will also be looking at all of the official crossovers to the series, in addition to devoting several episodes to the follow-up event, Zero Month, where Superman meets a brand new enemy.
Conduit.
Zero Hour.
Zero Month.
Only at From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast. From Crisis to Crisis can be found at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com, and is part of the Superman Podcast Network, which is located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
Also be sure to check out the Fortress of Baileytube, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytube.com. There you will find new episodes of From Crisis to Crisis, as well as all kinds of fun bits of business connected to Zero Hour and Zero Month.
And welcome back, and let's get right into it with acting, and that means it's time to go over our cast list. We have Bob Newhart playing Bernard, Ava Gabor voicing Miss Bianca, Michelle Stacy as Penny, Gerardine Page as Madame Medusa, Joe Flynn as Mr. Snoops, and in one of his last roles, Jim Jordan as Orville. I really enjoyed this cast. I thought Ava Gabor and Bob Newhart had just a great chemistry together. I would be interested to see if they worked together at all or if they worked separate, but whatever they did, they were able to nail down the chemistry that really made both Bianca and Bernard believable as a team. Bob Newhart just has this very warmth, funniness to him. That just makes him generally funny. It's one of the reasons for those who don't know, Bob Newhart had a very, very successful sitcom during the 70s and 80s. I believe it was the 70s, though. The Bob Newhart Show. I remember watching it on Nick at Night. But some of you youngins, who don't understand what it means to have to walk 15 miles uphill in the snow, his old man Tommy says. But it's one of the things that made his show very successful was he just has this very warmth, it's very just genuine, natural funniness to him that makes you laugh. And definitely that's at work here. And then you pair that with Ava Gabor, who did an absolutely wonderful job. Rather than say that she's sexy, she's sort of more maternal and caring. And it's this natural beauty from her voice. That I wouldn't call sexy, but and sensual, I think, pushes it too far as well. But just beautiful. I think that because she's beautiful and much more maternal. Their chemistry together, I thought, worked very well and really, really, I think, helped the film. They're definitely the stars of the film, and they lead it through every way. Miss Stacy as Penny, I thought, did a good job. She did no better and no worse than any other sort of kid actor in an animated movie during this time, for that matter. She was, for the most part, tolerable. Her voice very much reminds me of... I'm blanking on the name of that character. But the main character from Rock-a-Doodle-Doo, the boy who becomes the cat. Completely blanking on that. But she reminded me of the voice did, just a little lower, more girl-like. Gerardine Page, I thought did a great job as a villain. She really embellished this role as the villain. And her best scene by far, or a couple of her best scenes, for that matter, in this film, by far. One is when she's, getting dressed on the riverboat, and she's talking to Snoop about, basically, how do you control the child? And just relishing in being mean and nasty and evil. And then the scene to where they take her the next day to the hole. And just, the way she steals the teddy bear, just doesn't even blink an eye, and then you can feel it in the voice, if you ever want to see it again. You will get in that hole, and you're not coming up till you find... I mean, again, I'm not speaking verbatim here, but again, just the way she relishes in that evil. You know, there is no confusing that this character is mean and nasty. And there should be any confusion, and she does that wonderfully. Joe Flynn, I think, nails that bumbling, buffoonly henchman down pat. I think it's a great choice with the nasal aspect, which I can speak for myself as being very nasally myself right now. But if you don't hear, I don't know if you can hear or not. But that nasal aspect I think he added made Mr. Stoops very, a very good comic, not comic foil, but comic pairing with Madame Medusa. And then, of course, speaking of comedy, you have Jim Jordan as Orville, and the very few, you know, the fact of the matter is, next week we'll be reviewing The Rescuers Down Under, which I think one of the first times where we've ever, I mean, certainly we've done sequels, like Gone, next episode, we're doing a sequel to this series and things like that. But in regards to a Disney movie, this is one of the few times where Disney ever did a direct sequel to a film that they released in theaters. I mean, certainly during the Disney Renaissance, they had, I think, a sequel for, or ended up having a sequel for everything that was a success during the Disney Renaissance. But all of that went direct to DVD. And every, I think, aspect, or almost every aspect of it, the quality went down, mostly because, again, the animation quality was more ABC, TGIF animation than movie animation. But, you know, certainly here, you know, and I bring that up because when we watch that, there's going to be a lot more of the Albatross comedy character. Of course, that being played by John Candy, and we'll get to that when we get it. So there's not as much of that here, but the few moments here of Jim Jordan as Orville are, you know, very nice and very sweet, and the comedy there is very genuine, and he has that very genuine, funny feel to him that works very well. And then, of course, the rest of the voice cast, I thought, did a great job. I wonder who had to do the Fire Dragonfly, because goddamn, making that buzz a song. But again, added some real heart to that character that I thought worked very well. And then, of course, you know, the Bayou residents all had a lot of heart to them that I very much enjoyed. And I love their scenes together as well. And then, of course, you can't forget the cast, like Bernard Fox and everything that worked as the mice in the assembly. They did a great job as well. So, just overall, I thought the film, the voice cast, everybody that was part of the voice cast did an absolutely wonderful job. Definitely they did a great job of lending their voices to making these characters believable and adding some heart to them, because I think a lot of the heart does come from the voice cast. And you know what, it's heart that really makes this film work within its story. And you know, that's a great segue into story here, because you know, the main plot, very simple. You know, here's this girl, she's been kidnapped, and this Rescue Aid Society of mice have been, you know, sent two of their agents to rescue her. And, you know, the plot never vies away from the natural progression of this plot. But again, it's about the characters and just the heart of the characters. And you grow just finding yourself throughout the film really caring about these characters. And, you know, their plight and wanting to see them succeed. And again, it's something that's very rare in film, to where this is a great case of a film that may not have the best animation, may not have the best music, or in particular, music and animation, and even maybe a cast that, well, the cast has, but music and animation that maybe hasn't aged well because technology has skyrocketed. We've seen so many much more amazing things. But at the end of the day, what makes this film go so well is it just has heart in all the right places. And it's not exactly a thing you can exactly point to in this scene or that scene. There's so many, all these little scenes and little details of the way voices are done and the way animation is done. And little musical score keys here and there, and you know, decision to do this type of scene, and it's the natural flow of the film that forms this very natural heart to this film. And it's got this such heart is what I just keep finding myself going back to and describing the plot. It's the little animation that could, because, you know, in retrospect, as far as how it's aged, you know, just looking at the animation separately and looking at the music separately, comparing it to what's out now, there's no comparison. But if you allow yourself to sit down and gauge in the film, you find yourself just caring so deeply about the characters and their plight. And that's really their heart coming out and grabbing you and making you care about the film. And that's something that definitely works in this film's flavor. It's dinner time, folks, and I'm getting ready to eat. But definitely in its favor. So the simplicity, I think, helps that, because it allows you to focus more on the characters, their decision, the character interaction, which allows for that heart to come through. And certainly, like I said, it's what makes this film work so much. It's got such heart to it. There's such warmth to it. Part of that is the theme. Certainly there's a huge theme in this of, you know, it doesn't matter who you are or how little you are or if you're an orphan or anything. You know, it doesn't matter if you're even a little mouse. You can, you know, no matter who you are, you have the ability to do something about your situation. Whether that be a situation to where you're kidnapped, you know, or a situation to where, you know, your family needs to get money, or, you know, whatever your situation may be, you can always do something. Never tell yourself that I can't do anything. Because no matter whether you're big or small, whether you're tall or small, or whether you're fat or skinny, regardless of whether you're beautiful or not. And again, that's one of the contrasts of, you know, you have a much more beautiful Bianca paired with, again, this very everyman in Bernard. This is why that works so far. This isn't male patriarchal fantasy of the ugly guy being with the beautiful girl. In the case of this theme, this is, again, this is a great segue into the other thing, which is why the relationship of Bernard and Bianca works so well and why it helps the movie so much in regards to its theme of, here you have these vastly different people who both, you know, again, she's beautiful, but she's a woman in 1970s, and here's just every man that probably no one ever really notices. And yet, look at all this stuff they're doing. Look at the fact that they're outsmarting these horrible, horrible people. And eventually, they get their comeuppance because of the way they're outsmarting them. You know, and helping Penny to learn that she can, you know, do things. All she has to do is believe in herself. And believe in the fact that she can do it. That's just a very warm theme. And that's something, you know, I mean, there are cold themes that are just, like, cold and just, I don't want to say heartless, but it's like, you know, you cold in the sense that it gets brutal in getting its point across. But, you know, there's a lot of warmth, there's a lot of softness to the way they get their theme across in regards to showcasing, again, that relationship between Bernard and Bianca. And again, a lot of that credit has to go to animators and how well they did their designs, and the other has to go to the voice actors who did a great job of adding that warmth as well, with some great acting. But again, you have this very good relationship between Bernard and Bianca that's, while they definitely, especially in the second film, they play with that idea of romance a lot more, but here it's definitely something of, it's sort of, almost the Odd Couple effect, but just how really alike they are and how much they're able to do. And again, it helps the theme and add warmth to the theme, and ultimately that theme helps tend to great amount of heart that this film has. A thing I think that also helps this film is it moves along at a good pace. At no point did I really get tired of this film. I mind you, in watching this, I stepped away from it a few times for some other reason, but not because I was bored of the film. The film, I thought, moved at a good pace, and I never felt bored while watching it. And then, of course, the comedy. I think that's another thing I think that really lends to the warmth. Just a lot of old-school, old-fashioned, physical comedy, very Looney Tunes-esque, but also very natural, genuine, human comedy, I would call it. The type to where it's like, just, you know, the silly things we sometimes do that we don't notice, that makes these characters feel very real and very natural. And again, that lends itself to the warmth and the heart of the film. So overall, I think definitely the biggest strength of this movie goes to its story because of its theme, the character interactions that helped, that really helped to find this very simple plot with a lot of heart. But the other thing you also got to notice is that part of that comes from the really good character designs and the really good acting by its cast. So overall, you know, I was very surprised at how much I enjoyed this film. Because I really don't remember really ever watching this film. I think I watched it once, so I really didn't have a lot of memories. I mean, I think the one scene that's really shown of this film is the water skiing scene. So I think that's something that everybody probably remembers of this movie. It is one of those movies that is like, you know, I remember The Rescuers Down Under a whole lot more, and I remember watching that movie a lot more. I was very much more familiar while watching that movie than while watching this movie. But it's like one of those things, like, you know, I remember The Rescuers and spawning that sequel, but I just don't remember ever watching it. But here, I'm glad I watched it because, you know, it had a lot of warmth. And, you know, that's the thing at the end of the day is that after watching this movie, I felt very warm. And it just, again, that just came from all the heart that this little film that could had to it. And, you know, I highly suggest because this showed the promise that Disney had within itself. During a period where it had a lot of failure, this is one of its few successes, and I can see why, because, like I said, there's so much warmth and there's so much heart. And it, you know what? It showed the promise and the potential that Walt Disney Animation could be something again. And we only had to wait 10 more years, or 12 more years for that potential to be realized. I think this is historically important. Walt Disney animated film, because of the reasons I made mention before. And overall, it's just a nice, warm animated film that's just a great film for the whole family to sit down and watch and have fun watching. So, you know what? Despite not having probably the best songs and the best score, and, you know, having animation that hasn't possibly aged as well, you know what? The animation's still good. The score is still good. It is still a solid film. But what really makes it work is the fact that, like I made mention before, the warmth and just the amount of heart just really makes you enjoy this film. So I give The Rescuers a 4 out of 5. Just a wonderful film, and I highly suggest you watching it. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, if you have any emails or comments or anything that you'd like to send the show, you can send them several ways. One, you can send by email, by emailing to AppSolutionNetwork.com at 132@gmail.com. That's Absolution Network at 132@gmail.com. You can also search us out on Stitcher by going to www.stitcher.com and searching for the Absolution Network. You can listen to the podcast there and leave comments for us there. And you can always leave comments on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. And don't forget to search us out on Facebook by searching for the Absolution Network. Of course, while you're at the website, remember to check out all the other 132 Productions content. This, of course, includes the Otaku Momentum and the Anime Cast, and Shinsaga Curls Wrestling, and Anime and Video Game Fighting Videos, and John Ramos' Toku and Anime Videos. And, of course, all my other podcasts, that, of course, includes CM Juice Wrestling Reviews, Tom's Top 5, the Intergalactic Graphic Review, along with many others. And of course, you also have my Comic Book Crazy podcasting site at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com, featuring Hexcast and Spectacular Webs. And of course, my Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast that you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, while you're at any site, make sure you check out our sidebar with all our friends. That, of course, includes Michael Bailey and his views from the Long Box, Spidey Dude and the Clone Saga Chronicles, Steven Syker and the Critical Hit Podcast, and, of course, Scott Gardner and the 22 Freaks Podcasting Network. And that is it for this episode of Tom Sirago, ladies and gentlemen. And as I may mention before, next week, we follow to the direct sequel of this film, The Rescuers, with The Rescuers Down Under, released in, 1992. Yeah, 1992. Actually released after Beauty and the Beast, and a lot of people forget about it, because it was during the Disney Renaissance and caught in between, you know, Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. So, we're gonna have some fun next time. So until next time, my tsunami generation.
It's gonna get too dangerous for you.
Stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.